For this evening's Dharma talk, there was a couple of questions which people had given me concerning the Buddhist practice of letting go and anger and the attitudes of a good Buddhist, or really, you might say, the attitudes of a wise person in the world. And so this evening's talk is going to be focused around these questions about, like, the attitudes, where one comes from. And in particular, in Buddhism, we have a thing which we call the path to enlightenment, called the Eightfold Path. And very often we talk about certain factors of that Eightfold Path. But that second factor of the Eightfold Path is something which is very rarely discussed. And it's sometimes called right thoughts, sometimes called right intention. You might as well call it right attitude, or like right emotion. Because it's signifying the place where we come from. And whatever act of body, speech or mind we commit, it's usually where we come from is all important. Because if we're coming from a good place, it's certainly, in Buddhism, it's called good karma. No matter what the actual act is, as long as it's coming from a good place, it's good karma. And you can test that out by yourself, because what good karma means in your experience is that this act coming from a good place can only bring up happiness and well-being, harmony, and all the other good qualities which signify that it has to come from a good place. You can't get bad things coming from a good place. Similarly, if we find that we're acting, body, speech or mind, from a bad place, from a wrong intention, a wrong attitude, a wrong emotional support, a wrong emotional source, then you'd always find yourself getting into some sort of trouble, some sort of conflict, either inner conflict or external conflict. And the very fact that the conflict we experience in life with ourselves or with others creates so much bitterness and so much concern to human beings, it's the cause of so much suffering. It's very good actually to find out where all this conflict is coming from, and to be able to find out how we can create happiness and well-being and harmony, at least in ourselves and our local family, if not further throughout the society, throughout the world. So this focusing on the source of actions, the emotional source, the right attitude, the right intention, becomes a very important part of a human being's practice towards perfection, practice towards happiness. Because in Buddhism, we don't expect happiness to come from someone else. We have to make that happiness. It's up to you to do something. This is what karma is all about. That you are responsible. So we don't go around blaming other people. We look to ourselves and see what we need to do. Blaming other people, in Ajahn Chah's famous phrase, is like having itch on your head and scratching your bottom. Always remember that, because if you've got an itch on your head and you scratch your bottom, the itch doesn't go away. You are looking in the wrong place. If wherever the itch is, that's where you have to scratch. Pain, suffering, disappointment, where is that? Is that with the other person? Is the pain in the job which you have to, is the pain with your husband? Now the pain is in your heart, it's inside you. That's where the happiness is as well. Wherever it is, that's where you have to look. That's where you'll find the solution. And the problem is why people get frustrated in the world. It's because they've got the itch on their head and they're scratching the bottom all the time. No wonder they never get anywhere. So, we have to look at the source of all these things, the intention. And that is the source of karma. This is where we can really take responsibility. And we can find we're actually scratching in the right place because things start to work out. The way the Buddha taught the right intention, he says there's three types of right intention. And you can't really have one without the other two. And very often, like Buddhists, people who should know better, they usually get into trouble, they stuff things up, because they do one of these, but not the other two. Or maybe two, but not three. It's not a full purity of your attitude or intention. Those three right intentions are the intention or the attitude of letting go, the intention of loving-kindness, the attitude of compassion. those three things. That's called correct, right intention. The opposite of those, wrong attitude, wrong intentions, is intentions which come from like selfish desire, which come from ill will, or which come from cruelty. And each one of these, I think, is very easy to see. When you're selfish, when you just think of yourself, can you ever really get happiness? I can't, because even though that I might be happy by myself in my monastery, I've got a very lovely monastery, worked very hard for it, but I can't just stay there every Friday night. I've got to come out and help somebody else. And you find that that's the case because there is a realization, especially in your times of quietness, that you aren't alone in this world. There's other people around as well, and other people affect you. And you affect other people. There is always a connection between people, which is obvious when you really consider it, and you feel it, and you experience it. Because of that connection, I can't really be happy if I see other people suffering. Because the sight of that suffering comes into my mind, and exists in my mind, in my experience. There's that unhappiness there, seeing somebody who can do with some help. Sometimes you can't help people, but often you can. You can do something anyway. And this is just the natural compassion which comes up within people. And I think one of the difficulties of our modern age is to think that we're so alone. And to think that whatever I do is my right. But I've got personal rights which don't affect other people. And certainly that I can see that that's missing so much. I really haven't got a right to hurt myself. Because if I hurt myself, I hurt so many other people. In fact, many of you would hope, I think so anyway, that I'm going to be here for quite a few more years. So, you know, I haven't got really much choice. I have to live a healthy lifestyle. Otherwise I'd be disappointing somebody else. Isn't it the case that sometimes that people think that they've got a right to abuse their bodies, take alcohol and drugs, mess themselves around, because, well, it's my body, it's my choice. But really, if you hurt, especially if you hurt so much you have to go to hospital, just how many people does that hurt also? There's no one in this world hasn't got someone who loves them. Some monks love everybody, so at least you've got a few monks who love you. But there's also the nurses, the doctors, the people who care for you. They see someone suffering just as if you see someone suffer, that you hurt also. Seeing that connection between people means that just out of kindness for others, you should be kind to yourself. Because if you suffer, your suffering echoes. And it reverberates and it touches your people close to you. And it touches people even further away from you. It's like a black glow which touches so many people and creates misery in their lives as well. So, for the sake of other people, you have the duty to be kind to yourself, to look after yourself, to develop happiness in yourself. I certainly like to see happy people, don't you? Do you like to see miserable people? If you see a miserable person, it hurts in you. So the idea of like rights always will come with responsibilities. And the idea of like selfishness doesn't really make sense. Because just thinking about oneself just misses what happens to the rest of the world. The Buddha gave this simile once of throwing a stone in a pond. Now, you are the center of that pond. Where that stone hits first, you feel first. But those ripples from that pond eventually, after a few seconds of time, reach every corner, every inch of that surface of water. Every act which you do will reach other people sooner or later. That's why that selfishness is just plain stupid. What I mean by selfishness is just thinking of oneself. There's another type of selfishness which I think is quite good. Because I know that I'm happy if I create happiness in others. I'm happy if I'm generous. I'm happy if I'm kind. I'm happy if I give of myself to some other people. Because the happiness which I feel when I see other people having fun. Just in our monastery, down in Serpentine, there's so many animals who come to our dining room or just outside around about 10:30. They know it's feeding time, and they know that people are so generous, there's more than enough for the monks, and they get some food as well. Today there's a little kookaburra sitting on the railing, just waiting for the blessing to be given so the food would come out. The kookaburra sits on the railing. We have a second story dining room. Sits on the railing so he's got a very good view of the plates of all the people who are sitting underneath. And there with the literal bird's eye view, he can sort of spot whatever he likes and just go and take it. He lands on people's plates. We always know, we can't see the people's plates, we always know because there's always a scream. Ah! And the little bird takes whatever he wants and goes flying up on the tree. And it's, people really don't mind because it's delightful. Even though that sometimes it's its dinner. I remember we had a bricklayer once working in our monastery. And he had some sausages which his wife had cooked for him. And he got a plate out with his lunch hour and put the sausage on his plate. And after a few seconds, in a flurry of feathers, this bird came down and pinched his sausage. And he started complaining to me, "That's my dinner!" But he did it with a smile. Because even though he went a little bit hungry that day, it was just so much fun to see a bird enjoying its meal. But with a kookaburra, because of their nature, they have to kill before they'll eat their food. And thinking the sausage was a big worm, the kookaburra, holding the sausage in its mouth, kept banging it against the tree. Bang, bang, bang. And so he was sure the sausage was dead. And only then would it eat the sausage. But it's so much fun to see animals enjoying that food. And why was that? Because that lack of selfishness, seeing others having happiness, is a great source of happiness for oneself. And this is that selflessness, the letting go, which is the true meaning of letting go. Letting go of concern for oneself when one helps others. This is that attitude of just plain loving kindness. You know why sometimes people don't have any happiness in this world? Because they are just basically too selfish. And because they're selfish, they don't know that happiness. Very often giving to others is a great source of happiness for oneself. And this is one of the reasons we can do this, just for the sake of happiness itself. I often tell people who are upset or depressed, or something's happened to them in their life which has caused them great pain. Because when we're in those situations of depression or pain or grief, so often all we're concerned about is ourselves and our own pain, our own suffering. And to get out of that depression, one of the most wonderful ways, which is much better than Prozac or going to see a psychiatrist, is actually to go and help somebody else, to do some service for others, to stop thinking of yourself and go giving to another. Sometimes it's hard to do when you're in such a mess or you're so much difficulty or so much pain or disappointment. But you try that. And for a moment when you're not thinking of yourself and your mind is focused on someone else, on their needs, when it's coming from loving kindness or compassion for someone else, the perspective in your mind changes. So often the sense of anger or ill will, disappointment, frustration or even depression, all it is a wrong perspective. Sometimes our problems, our disappointments, they're so close to us. We can't get the perspective, like the old simile, which I usually use. How big is a hand? A hand is as big as how close it is to your eyes. My hand is right here, it's so close to my eyes, I can't see any of you here. And I put it out where it belongs, at the end of my arm, I can see my hand and all of you as well. The size of the hand has not changed. It is the perspective which is altered. In the very same way, the size of your problem, if you hold it so close to yourself, that's called selfishness. It's my problem, it's so big, it's so huge, you cannot see anything else in the whole world. If you put it out somewhere else, where it really belongs, then you have perspective. The problem's size hasn't changed. but you can see so much more. It was similar to the Buddha's advice in the time of the Buddha to a lady who had lost her only son. This was a story of Kisa Gotami. This lady who had lost her only son, even though it was dead, went to different doctors because she was in denial. She didn't think her child was really dead, and she hoped that some doctor or some magic monk with psychic powers could bring her child back to life. And at this particular time, there was a monk in that area with psychic powers who happened to have the name, the Buddha. And so, full of hope, she went to this monk and asked this monk to bring her child back to life. How often is it then when we're in depression, anger, disappointment, are we in denial, and we want someone to try and fix our problem for us? And the Buddha actually didn't fix the problem, but he put it in perspective. He moved the death of one person into a perspective where she could see the death of many people. He told this lady to go to the houses and to collect 3 mustard seeds because he wanted to make a magic potion which would solve all her problems. She thought this potion would manage to bring her child back to life. So he went to the village and she got 3 mustard seeds, but the point was, the Buddha told her that the mustard seed had no power if it came from a house where someone had died. It had to come from a house where no one had ever died, otherwise it wouldn't work to solve her problem. So she went to the first house and asked for the mustard seed, and the person in the house said, yeah, no worries. I did actually say no worries, because I didn't say that in India at the time, but they said something like the same. That's Australian house, you get no worries. But anyhow, when they asked, has anyone died here, they said, yeah, of course, because these are old villages in the time of India, they've been there for a long time. And say, yeah, the old grandma died a couple of weeks ago. Sorry, we can't use that mustard seed. Next house, has anyone died? Yeah, someone died in childbirth about a year ago. Oh, sorry, can't use that. Next house, knocking on the door. Can I help you? You've got a mustard seed? Yeah. But has anyone died here? Yeah. Someone died in a chariot accident, 2 days ago. So they couldn't use that mustard seed. Knocked on every door of this house, of their villages, until she finally got the message that in every house someone had died. And when she realized that, sort of the old penny dropped, as they used to say, her insight arose. For a long time she'd been thinking that the death of her child was the only thing which mattered in the whole universe. It was an attitude problem. When she realized that the death of her child was also the death of many children, of many middle-aged people, of many old people. She had the same problem, but in a different perspective. And she understood the reason behind the Buddha's strategy. The Buddha didn't want to bring her child to life. The Buddha wanted to bring her to life. The Buddha wanted to make her understand that bringing a child back to life would not solve the problem, because sooner or later, her child will die or she will die. There has to be some separation. The Buddha wanted her to know the right perspective about life and death. Death happens, it's out there, but it's also surrounded by life as well. And I've used that simile in some of the funeral services in a different way, asking people to imagine in the wide world how many people at the same time are also grieving for the loss of a son, a daughter, a father, a wife, a husband. When you realize just how many people are feeling exactly the same as you right now, then the problem is in perspective. When you realize how many people have felt like you and now are free from that pain, the problem is put in perspective. When you realize that how many people will feel like that in the future, the attitude has changed from selfishness, just me, to just the problem of the whole existence. This is part of the fabric of life for everyone, not just you. The selfish, just me, this has just happened to me, why me? We all take our turn from time to time. When something terrible happens to you, you always say, why me, why me? When you win the lotto, no one ever says, why me? that whatever happens, when we have the right perspective, the right attitude, things start to change. So we have an idea of like letting go of non-selfishness, but we also have to have it with our regard for other people, our loving kindness and our compassion. And these three have to go together. Sometimes, some Buddhists, they think they're letting go. So I'm just letting go. I'm letting, especially sometimes I've got to be very careful when I talk about letting go to some of the young people who are still studying because they go home and say, I'm going to let go of my homework this evening. Or some of them, I'm going to let go of doing the dishes. Well, the point is that that's only a third of the right attitude. Now, why are you letting go? Is it really out of selflessness? Or is it really out of desire? Is it just too freaking lazy? Very often it's just laziness, isn't it? It's not real letting go. And there was a story in the time of Ajahn Chah that this monk was staying in one of the huts in the monastery in Thailand, a very simple hut. And one night during a storm, a sheet of the tin roofing blew off. And the rain continued. And this monk, instead of actually doing something to repair the hut, he just moved his bed and all his stuff to the other side. So half the hut was wet, but he was on the dry half. And when Ajahn Chah saw that, he blasted the monk. He said, what are you doing? He said, I'm letting go. And Ajahn Chah said, you know, have these like water buffaloes in Thailand who just munch grass all day. So that's a letting go of a buffalo. And just as stupid. He said, you've got responsibilities. Even a monk has got responsibilities, which is part of like loving kindness. It's responsibilities for others. You might be okay just living on that side of the hut, but when you leave, who else is going to use that hut? Don't just think of yourself, think of others as well. Think of yourself as a part of a community. A great community of monks, a great community of Buddhists, a great community of human beings, a great community of all beings. When you look upon yourself as a community of all beings, you have responsibilities and duties as well. That's part of basic loving kindness, of compassion for all beings, and also compassion for huts as well. Make sure you look after the huts you live in. So the Ajahn Chah was just reminding him of his responsibilities which go along with letting go. Letting go of your own desires, your own selfishness, letting go of what you want, and being kind and being compassionate instead. When you develop that letting go together with kindness and together with compassion, you start to get on the right track. You find this beautiful balance in life because when you have loving kindness and compassion and letting go, you realize that balance is there are times to really let go and just relax. There are times to work. There are times to put forth effort for your own well-being. And there are times to put forth effort for the well-being of others. And I know this from personal experience. If I work too hard for others and don't have enough time for myself in the monastery, you get burnt out. If you just spend time by yourself and don't care about others, you get dry. There's no joy and no spark, even in your meditation. I've seen this just with many monks who I've grown up with. Some monks haven't taken on as much responsibility as I have, and they spent lots of time meditating in their huts or in their caves. And I was actually quite surprised, you know, when I sort of came to speak with them afterwards, how's your meditation going? Sort of okay, but not so good. When I really started to talking about wisdom, I had much better meditation than they had. And it was surprising sometimes, because I'd spent a lot of time, as people have known me for a long time, even coming here, spending a lot of time actually building the monastery down at Serpentine, spending a lot of time with others, looking after, taking on responsibilities and duties. Why was it that my even personal meditation was much quieter? And the reason I found afterwards is because if you are selfish and self-centered, concerned about yourself, you can't let go of what you really need to let go of to get peaceful meditation. When you're so concerned about you, you are a control freak. And those of you who've meditated, if you meditate as a control freak, what happens? Come on, get peaceful. I'm telling you now to shut up, be quiet. This is what you say to yourself. Come on, be quiet, watch your breath, be silent. How many times have you meditated? You've been coming here for years now and you still can't meditate properly. Now, if you had a boss at work like that, a person who was always on your back criticizing you, telling you what to do every moment of the day, what would you do? You'd tell him where to get off, wouldn't you? You'd get angry, you'd upset, you wouldn't. That's not the way to lead or to get things done. In the same way that when I come here of a weekend, when I have a driver who drives me up here because it's too far to walk, that I always tell them, just take me to the monastery. I don't keep telling them every few minutes, come on, take me to the monastery, come and get me to the monastery, when are we going to get to the monastery, don't go this way, don't go that way, look, come on. And if I talk like that, even before they got 100 metres outside of the monastery, they get out of the car and said, you drive if you want to give so many orders. Have you ever noticed that you do that very often? Always giving orders, always trying to control, never allowing the driver to do the job. And this is what happens in our meditation. We become that control freak, even our meditation. Come on, be quiet. So watch the breath. Come on, watch the breath. Watch it this way, watch it that way. Go this way, come on. You never give yourself a moment of silence inside. No wonder the mind rebels and doesn't do what you want it to. The middle way, the balance, is not letting go and say, okay, just see what happens. Nor is it becoming control free. It's the same way that I come every Friday to this center. When I get into the car, I tell the driver once, go to Nolamara. And I spend the rest of the time looking out the window. And sure enough, after about an hour, I get to Nolamara. Great, isn't it? In the same way, try that with your meditation. You start to say, okay, be quiet. And shut up. And see what happens. Trouble is, we can't shut up, can we? We can't sit in the car and look out the window. We've always got to talk to the driver. Find out what's going on. Always taking control. That's the opposite of letting go. The balance is in between. Where we give guidance. And we have times of being quiet. This is like how we can work with compassion, with loving kindness, towards ourselves and towards others. A balance between activity and silence, giving direction and letting go. Being kind to others, being kind to ourselves. That's why in the meditation, sort of a powerful technique to use to make the mind quiet. Whatever stage of meditation you begin with, tell yourself what you want the mind to do. I want the mind to be in the present moment. And then stop and listen and see if the mind follows what you suggest. But give the mind a chance to do the work. Once you know the ways of the mind in meditation, it becomes good fun doing this. One of the first meditation retreats I went to, the teacher knew the way of the mind. He said, when you get up in the morning, don't bother to set your alarm clocks. He said, just tell yourself when you go to bed at night, I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock. Tell yourself very clearly. And he said, then forget about it and go to sleep. And I did that, and it worked. Every morning I was getting up at 5 o'clock. Just a natural alarm clock. Because you're actually programming your mind. You're giving instructions to your mind, clear instructions to the mind. And you're letting the mind get on with it. So this is a way, an example, just how you can balance the mind between being a control freak and being completely sloppy and lazy. To say, when I have to remember something, knowing the way the mind works like a computer, I actually tell myself, I must remember, today at 3 o'clock somebody's going to come. Instead of keep on worrying about it, I've got to remember at 3 o'clock someone's going to come, I've got to remember at 3 o'clock someone's going to come. You go crazy that way. she's also got to remember someone coming at 2 o'clock and someone coming at 3:05 as well. You have so many things to remember, don't you? So instead of doing that, another way of working, or how I work with the mind, I just programming it in, key it in, just like in a computer. Abraham, remember, 3 o'clock, you've got to remember that someone's coming. I say it to myself 3 times just to make sure, and then I stop and forget about it. And I've done that so many times, and I trust that mind, I've got confidence in it, and it works. At 3 o'clock, a thought comes in the mind. Somebody's coming, I've got to go out of my hut and meet them. Try that. Experiment with that. And you'll find it's a way of not having to worry about remembering so many things. You're programming it in, and it'll come out at the right time. So this is a way of simplifying and balancing the life. Instead of like controlling, we can let go more. But it's not let going and just being completely irresponsible. It's taking that balance, so we're letting go when it's the time to let go, doing when it's time to do something. A good example of this is the story about when there's nothing to do, do nothing. When there's something to do, give it everything you've got. And this was a story which was told to me, which gives a very good indication of how to deal with the difficulties and problems in life, the big problems in life, which come to you from time to time. This was a story which was told to me when I was a school teacher by another teacher who'd been in Burma during the Second World War. He was on a patrol in the jungles when the scout with a small number of soldiers came back to report that they stumbled into a huge number of Japanese soldiers. And this man, this teacher, said that his first thought was, we're probably going to die, but let's try and fight our way through. Maybe we can take some of the enemy with us. I think we've been watching too many movies. But the commanding officer was much wiser. He said, so we're surrounded, we're outnumbered. Okay, it's a time for a cup of tea. It's the British Army. And this young soldier thought the commanding officer was mad, was crazy. How can you think of a cup of tea when you're surrounded by Japanese soldiers and you're about to die? What would you do? You'd probably try and fight your way through as well. But this was an army, and he had to follow orders. So he had to get some water and make some tea, and they're just about to drink it when the scout came back and said, the enemy have moved. Quick, put everything away, we can escape. And of course he did escape, that's why he could tell the story. And he escaped because when there was nothing to do, when he was completely surrounded by the enemy and there was no way out, when there was nothing to do, they did nothing. They waited. They got their energies together. And when there was something to do, when the enemy had moved, then they acted quickly and they escaped. Isn't it the case what happens to us in life from time to time? Something very terrible is happening to us, we don't know what to do. Life seems to be falling to pieces around us. The future looks terrible. And what do? We don't struggle. So when everything is going wrong in your life, when your wife is leaving you, when your children are leaving home, creating problems, and the police are coming around knocking on the door, when you've lost your job, when the bank manager says you've run out of money, when you're very sick, when everything is going wrong, have a cup of tea. Or a cup of coffee if you prefer coffee. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. And what that means is because everything is always changing, the world is always moving, it's called anicca, impermanence, change. It means you're waiting, you're ready. And when there's something to do, you give it everything you've got. And that was the other teaching which Ajahn Chah once gave this young man from Australia who went to visit him, who tried to have an interview with Ajahn Chah just a year or two before he could no longer speak. But it was so, at that time he was so famous, surrounded by so many people, he couldn't get close to this great master. So having gone all the way to see this monk specially, realizing that he couldn't get close, it was an hour or two before his train left to go back to Bangkok, he saw some monks picking up brooms and sweeping the monastery surroundings. He thought he'd pick up a broom and at least do some sweeping. Do some good karma anyway, at least, you know, waste a bit of time. And as he was sweeping the monastery grounds, he felt a hand on his shoulder. He turned round. It was Ajahn Chah, who'd seen this Westerner come all this way. And Ajahn Chah did not have time to teach him deep Dhamma, deep teachings, or much about Buddhism. He was on his way to another appointment. He was a very busy monk. But through an interpreter, he gave this young Australian a teaching, which when this Australian came and told me this story, because I never knew this story before, he said it was one of the most useful teachings he'd ever got. He said it helped him understand himself and understand what to do in life. And Ajahn Chah's teaching was very simple. He told him, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then he turned around and went. Very simple teaching like that. If you're going to teach, so you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. So let me teach you. If you're going to teach, give it everything you've got. If you're going to brush your teeth, give it everything you've got. And if you're going to rest, give it everything you've got. In other words, give yourself 100% to what you're doing now. If it's time to rest, rest. If it's time to work, work. If it's time to study, give it 100%. If it's time to be silent, give it 100%. A very simple teaching, but very effective in life. And that young man took that back and he was very successful, very happy, just because of that very simple teaching. Whatever you do, give it 100%. Even resting. Because so often in our lives we are divided in our mind. Half of us is doing one thing, half is doing something else, and half is doing a third thing. That's three halves. That's what it feels like sometimes. That's what stress is all about, isn't it? Now, stress is being stretched with two ends, with two parts of our mind, one part going one direction, another part going another direction. That's what we mean by stress. You've only got one thing in your mind at a time. If you're giving 100% to one thing, you don't feel stress. You know what stress is? I'm doing this thing, but I've got to get this finished because something else I have to do afterwards. You've got two things in the mind, not just the one you're doing now, but the one you're going to do next. And sometimes the one which is after that as well, sometimes three things in the mind. That's what stress is. If you do one thing at a time and give that everything you've got, you find you can achieve a lot. A whole monastery in Serpentine is built just one brick at a time. That's what I remember when I started. If I'd have been told how many buildings you'd have to put up there, how much work I'd have to do, how many nails I would have to put in the wood, and how many wouldn't go in the wood and the hammer would hit my finger, I would have never done that. I tell people it's true, there's blood, my blood, on every building in the monastery. Because I wasn't always a good builder. I try to be mindful, but you know, sometimes the hammer sort of had a life of its own. It's called anatta, non-self. But anyway, it was a lot of work. And the only way you could do that, build a huge monastery, is one brick at a time. Let's do this brick which is happening now. Forget about all the other bricks. Let's do this job today. Forget about the jobs waiting until tomorrow. That way there was no stress. And also that way it became quite a well-built, beautiful monastery. We didn't have some great plans on what it would turn out like. But when you gave 100% attention to the moment, to what's happening now, that was the right attitude. And that was the right attitude of full effort into what needed to be done. And when the building was over, because you've given full effort, 100% effort into what you were doing, each brick, when it was over and it was rest time, you had 100% effort into resting. That was how I discovered how the meditation was going good. Because when I was laying the bricks, I was creating the attitudes of mind, which I also used in my meditation. The attitudes of my mind, which I keep using throughout all of my life. Giving it full attention, full mindfulness on that brick, full energy, selflessness, compassion, kindness, all of those attitudes were there even when I was laying a brick. And because of that, when all the bricklaying was finished, and I was sitting on my cushion to meditate, it was exactly the same mind state as laying the brick. Mindful, with energy, just this one breath at a time. That's all I was concerned with. And one breath at a time, after a very short period, just like building a hut, the hut was finished. After a very short period, the meditation was beautiful. It was because you had that full attention, that kindness. Because you can only have full attention with the kindness if I laid those bricks and I thought, what am I laying these bricks for? I didn't become a monk to lay bricks. This is not right. Someone else should lay bricks. The Buddhist Society of West Australia, they got all this fun. They should pay for a bricklayer. I should be meditating. I should be reading books. I shouldn't be doing this sort of stuff. They're just used as slaves. That's all. And I bet as soon as these huts are finished, I'll throw us monks out and they'll send in the nuns. You can think like that, can't you, when you get up there? I'm just being used. Now, if I'd have thought like that, that, what we call in Buddhism, the fault-finding mind, would mean that I wouldn't enjoy laying those bricks. The bricks wouldn't have been very beautiful when they were laid, because I'd have been plonking them down, oh, this will do, I don't care. And it wouldn't have looked very nice, because I wouldn't be giving it 100% effort. Only when you give it care and kindness and full effort does it turn out right. In the same way that when I was meditating, yeah, I've got to meditate now, breathing in, breathing out. What am I supposed to do this for? What is this all about anyway, breathing in, breathing out? I bet it doesn't work. I bet those other monks, they can't meditate either. This is a big scam, that's what it is. No one really gets enlightened. Breathing in, breathing out, this is just another sort of con game. If you had that sort of mind state, of course it would never work. Because you'd be putting in that negativity and that fault-finding mind. So because the way I lay bricks was with that right attitude, selflessness, it needs to be done, so I'm just going to do it. I remember actually one time, just wandering off a bit, you know that our big Dhamma hall, the main meditation hall at the monastery, I had an argument with a previous abbot over that. I thought that was a rotten design. You shouldn't build it that way, build it another way. But then afterwards, after having an argument with Ajahn Chakra over the design of the building, I thought, hang on, that's not the right way of going about things. So I went to his hut and I apologized. And I said, like, I apologize. I still disagree with you, but I apologize. And just for my own practice, please let us follow your design, but I want to be the one who builds it. And so even though I disagreed with it, and even though I argued with it, I wanted to build it. And I put extra care and effort into building that Dhamma hall. And that was marvellous. When I didn't agree with it, I gave it 100%. And that was a marvellous training for me to discipline me. Isn't it the case you only want to do what you like to do? I was doing what I didn't want to do, and giving it all of my effort. And that's why my meditation really starts to take off. Sometimes, I'm the same, I meditate, I don't want to meditate. I want to sleep. Especially at 4 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes you get up late at night, but you get up. Either I don't want to meditate, I'm going to give it 100%. And then you start enjoying it. The fault-finding mind is what stops you having any energy at all. If you get into that fault-finding mind, it never stops. You know, I remember going to visit my mother in England once. Talk about whinging poms. I was just walking to my mother's place, and I had these two young men were waiting for a bus, and they were sitting on a garden wall, and they were complaining. Because the garden wall, the top layer of bricks, were rounded and they weren't flat. And they say, they should do something about this. It's not comfortable to sit on. They should make them flat, not rounded to the top. I thought, come on, at least you've got a place to sit down. But when you get that fault-finding mind, nothing is perfect. Even if it's flat, it's too flat. It's not high enough. It should be higher. It should be warmer. They should put some sort of upholstery on these bricks so people can really sit down comfortably, or whatever else it is. Because you get the fault fired in mind and nothing is perfect. And that is one of the wrong attitudes, because the fault-finding mind is what's coming from ill will. It's the wrong attitude. It's the wrong second factor of the Eightfold Path. It's the opposite of loving-kindness, fault-finding. Loving-kindness forgives faults and is more accepting and more embracing, and doesn't see the faults in something, but sees the good in it. See, there's a usefulness in it. You don't go around criticizing other people, but you go feeling grateful for them. Look at the people you stay with and you live with. Are they perfect? Think of all the rotten things about them. All their mistakes and all their terrible things. It's easy to do, isn't it? What happens? What's your mind like when you think like that? You get upset, you get angry, and what am I living with this person for? Why don't I leave? Why don't I get divorced? Why don't I go and find somebody else? That's what happens when you develop the fault-finding mind. We have loving-kindness instead. Loving-kindness is forgiving, accepting, embracing. It sees not just their faults, but their other good qualities. It leads to harmony. It leads to peace. It leads to no arguments, but appreciating each other. Are you really appreciated in your relationship? Now, sometimes I can feel that up here, and I'm not really appreciated. I come here every day, and never once has anyone clapped after the talk. I'm joking, because I know that people appreciate me. That gratitude, when someone actually comes up to you and said, I really appreciated what you did. Isn't it wonderful when they say that? And what happens afterwards? I always tell people who come to the monastery to bring food. I say, I really appreciate it. I'm really glad to see you. Because if you weren't here, I'd go hungry. But you really appreciate people. Because when you actually have that, instead of the fault-finding mind, sort of the all-embracing, the kind, the loving mind, it's the right attitude. It stops all of the thoughts and the problems inside. You don't think so much, the more kind you are. All of your thinking, how much of it comes from fault-finding? What happens when you have a loving mind, a kind mind? Do you think so much? Most of thinking comes from looking at faults. What's wrong? And then, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. When you look at what's right, oh, this is so wonderful. You're quiet, you're peaceful. That's why the loving-kindness, when it starts in the mind, leads to peacefulness in the mind, acceptance in the mind, silence in the mind. Silence is a result of loving kindness, of acceptance, of putting down the fault for a while and resting. So to give oneself some peace of mind, we stop the fault finding. And so what I did with that hall, which I didn't like, instead of fault finding, I decided to love that hall. And it's actually quite a nice hall now. It's just my stupidity. I was looking at it in a particular way, a particular perspective, and that was wrong. And I couldn't see anything right with it. Now I just see what's right with it, and very little which is wrong with it. It's just perspectives, that's all. Those attitudes which you put into what you do create your happiness or your suffering. And so when we understand that these are the right attitudes, part of the Eightfold Path, to make sure that we develop a source of our actions, of body, speech, and mind, a source of our thoughts as well, of selflessness, of kindness and compassion, is going to lead to happiness. But if you develop a source of fault-finding, a source of selfishness, a source of cruelty and ill-will, it's only going to cause suffering, disharmony, pain, even depression in your own life. So this is the way we can understand what we mean by letting go has to be associated with loving kindness and effort. That balance, when it's something to do, do something. Give it everything you've got. When it's time to relax, relax. When you have that ability to just be equanimous, to be balanced, then you know all about how to live with right attitude. So there we go. There's a little talk this evening on right attitude, how letting go should be balanced in your life, and all about the second noble truth. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. Right attitude, right intention, sometimes called right thoughts, the right emotional base for one's actions in life. Are there any questions? Okay. That's really embarrassing, isn't it? Okay. That's a first in this place, isn't it? Okay, next week we want the glass stand as well, please. Okay, you had a question? Okay, it's more easy to be critical than to be kind. Why is that so? It's just like our conditioning, and our society is usually much more critical, usually focuses on the faults, focuses on what's wrong. And we just don't train ourselves to be grateful, to be appreciative, so to be grateful and appreciative. All the hard work which Mr. Howard does. Why are you laughing? Yeah. It is a lot harder because it is the way of the world and you meet other people who are also quite critical. And we tend to actually to be like sheep, and we are very heavily influenced by the people around us. And if other people are critical, we tend to be critical also. Sometimes it takes a lot of inner strength to go against the stream and to be in a crowd of people always criticizing, and then you standing up and seeing the good part in the other person, defending them. It's the same when you're being critical of yourself. It takes a little bit of effort to look at what's good about yourself. It's similar to the older trick of psychologists when someone was depressed, because that was like a result of fault finding. They couldn't see nothing good in themselves. And so they would put a sheet of paper in front of them and say, write something good about yourself. And they couldn't do it. And they'd encourage them. What did you do good today? And they'd say, I gave the cat a saucer of milk. Great, put that down, that's very kind. They're looking after your cat. That's sort of nothing. What else good have you done? And what one finds is once the first thing has been put down, the first item of goodness and gratitude and kindness may take about 5 minutes to get out of you. The next one will only take 1 minute. The next one, 10 seconds. And then before they know it, they've filled up this whole sheet of all the good things they've done today, all the kind acts which they've done today. And then they look at that, and it's in front of them. They realize they're not as bad as they thought they were. One gets into a mind state, just locked into one particular attitude. And these little tricks like this is to give you the, almost like get your head and turn it around the other side. So you see, another way of looking at it. When you see both ways of looking at it, and you get the right attitude, then you're fine. At this point, I just mentioned the old simile of the brick wall at a monastery. When I started working at the monastery, I know some of you heard this hundreds of times, but please don't be fault-finding. When I started work at the monastery, I couldn't lay bricks, I had to learn. They were very hard to lay. I'd be very slow. If they weren't right, I'd take them off and start again. Brick by brick, I laid my first brick wall. When it was all dry, the cement was hard, I looked back and found there was 2 bricks which were wrong. Instead of being level, they were at a terrible angle. As a result of that, I was very upset. Because that was my first brick wall I'd stuffed up. I made a mess of it. I wanted to destroy it. I wanted to bulldoze it, blow it up, but the other monks wouldn't let me. And when anyone went past that wall, whenever anyone came to visit, I would take them somewhere else because I didn't want to see my mistake. But what happened next was, a few months later, someone came and I was with them and they saw that wall and they said, that's a beautiful brick wall. And my first response was, have you left your glasses in the car? Can't you see those 2 bad bricks? And the point next was the most important part of this story. The person with me said, yes, I can see those two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 good bricks as well. And it was the first time in many months that I'd seen anything in that wall other than the mistakes. I needed someone else to point out to me there was something else in that wall other than the two bad bricks. And I realized straight away that was how I was looking at many things in life. The fault-finding mind goes straight to those two bad bricks and can't see anything else. With your husband, your parents, your children, your friends, when you get angry, that's all you can see, the two bad bricks, and you can't see anything good in them at all. And you want to destroy that wall, blow it up, bulldoze it, because you can't stand it at all. When anyone else comes up and says, your husband is a really good bloke. Say, what, him? And then they say, kind of see his two bad bricks. They say, yeah, but also see his 998 good ones as well. And sometimes you can't see those when you're angry and upset. That's what the fault-finding mind is. It just sees a part of reality. So what loving kindness does, it sees the whole wall. Yeah, there's faults there, there's good bricks there as well. That's how to get out of the fault-finding mind. Okay, Mr. Howard does terrible things with the GST, but he does some good things as well. Does he? Well, no one's all bad. And there's sort of the story about this. So this is actually supposed to be a true story. There's this one fellow who was at work, and he would never say anything bad about anybody. And it's really upset the other workers there. So they were talking together and decided to really sort of test this guy out. And they said, what about Adolf Hitler? What good can you say about him? And straight away this fellow, which is so positive, he said, well, Adolf Hitler, at least he was a leader in his field. So there's a positive attitude about everything. So instead of having a fault-finding mind, you can have the one which sees all the bricks in the wall. Be careful, because otherwise you go around destroying relationships, destroying jobs, destroying businesses, destroying yourself. Isn't that the case with suicides? People just see the two bad bricks in the wall for themselves. Thank you. I don't know if you've known anyone who's committed suicide, but sometimes you wonder, they had so much goodness in them. They had so much going for them. Why did they do that stupid thing? Because all they could see was two bad bricks. And they wanted to destroy themselves. All it needed was someone to say, there's 998 good bricks in you as well. Can't you see those ones as well? And then they would have something to live for. Be careful of that brick wall simile and the fault-finding mind. Okay, so before people find fault with me going on too long, we'll finish off now with some announcements from our President, James Benakis.